Hello and welcome to the Middle East Podcast, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's current affairs talk show focusing on Central Asia. I'm Bruce Pannier, host of the Middle East and author of the weekly Central Asia and Focus newsletter. Gulnara Karimova is one of the most infamous contemporary figures in Central Asia. The daughter of Uzbekistan's first president, Gulnara was spoiled, arrogant, and avaricious. In a U.S. diplomatic cable from 2005 leaked by WikiLeaks, a U.S. diplomat refers to Gulnara as the, quote, single most hated person in Uzbekistan, unquote. Despite this reputation, Gulnara was able to use her relationship to the Uzbek president to illegally amass a fortune that included property and assets in foreign countries. And it appears there was no shortage of people and organizations both inside and outside Uzbekistan willing to help her acquire these ill-gotten gains. A recent report from Freedom for Eurasia entitled Who Enabled the Uzbek Princess details how Gulnara was able to procure some $240 million in property in more than half a dozen countries, and who helped her. To discuss all this, I am fortunate to be joined by the primary authors of that recent report, Laila Nazgul Saitbek, chairwoman and founder of Freedom for Eurasia, Christian Laslett, professor of criminology at the University of Ulster, and Thomas Main, research fellow at the University of Oxford. Thank you all for joining me. And to start, for the benefit of our audience who might not be so familiar with Gulnara Karimova, could you please describe the person at the center of this tangled web of crime and corruption? And I'll start with you, Christian, if that's okay. But Laila and Tom, I want to hear what you have to say about her too. Who is Gulnara Karimova, Chris?
Yeah, thanks, Bruce. So Gulnara Karimova is the daughter of Uzbekistan's first president, Islam Karimov. And Islam Karimov was in power from 1991 as president until his death in late 2016. And during the period of his rule, obviously it was an autocratic one, but it was also one where there emerged a shadow government of very powerful figures within the regime who were able to use the authoritarian state as their own personal devices. And there were a range of really powerful families that were at the zenith of their sort of power during this period. One of the obviously most powerful families was the Karimov family. They weren't the only one, though. There were other powerful families associated particularly with the security services, which was then known as SMB, and a few other big packs of powerful individuals. But certainly Gulnara Karimova, in her own right, became a very powerful political player. From about 2001, prior to that, she'd been living in the United States with her husband, Mansur Maksudi, who is from an Uzbek-American family. And they had an unfortunate divorce in 2001. And Gulnara moved back to Uzbekistan from the US. And then she really began to build a political empire, using her father's office to build her own influence network. And from there, she was able to pretty much use government like her own personal violin. She could have decisions made in any agency within the prosecutor general's office. There was evidence that she was able to write court decisions. And she was applying that power to growing her own business empire. It began in areas like soft drinks, where she famously was involved in allegedly taking over her former husband's interest in the Coca-Cola bottlers project there. She then proceeded to build a distinct footprint in the telecommunications sector. And from there, she and obviously once she'd established a footprint in the telecommunications sector, she really used her political authority to make her own own personal economic territory. So anyone who wanted to come in to the telecommunications sector had to come through her. And that was where obviously there were a lot of international companies who are very interested in growing their own market share by coming into Central Asia and coming into Uzbekistan. And they were prepared. And in order to get access to that market, in order to get the licenses and the spectrum, they had to pay substantial bribes to Gulnara Karimova, which were then laundered through a series of sham commercial transactions processed through offshore companies and through offshore bank accounts, and through those and that led to Vimpelcom, MTS, and Telesonera, all international telecommunication companies, paying upwards of about $800 million in bribes over a decade period. And also she's there's fairly significant evidence points to the fact that she also had significant control over other sectors like gas and oil as well, and received benefits, quite significant benefits, from a company called Zeromax that was really a major private player at the time. But then, of course, just to finish off, she famously had a massive political downfall. And that transpired when someone within her network, someone with access to a lot of documents and with a grievance, potentially then leaked a lot of that information, and that led to exposés in the media. And then there was political machinations in Uzbekistan against her, particularly from within the security services, who are a bit irritated by the amount of economic territory she was monopolizing, and that led to her house arrest and then subsequent charge and imprisonment. And that's really where we got to today.
Great. Thank you, Chris. And Laila, actually, I want just a little bit more about Gulnara Karim, about her character, right? This is not an ordinary child of a Central Asian leader. I mean, some other children of Central Asian leaders have done quite well, but they've done it quite quietly. But Gulnara was not really the quiet type, was she?
No, she really had this glamorous life of a celebrity. Like, she was, you know, she was posing as a singer, and she had her fashion line, and she was designing her jewelry, and she was also actively kind of promoting herself online on social media, and was always kind of in the limelight.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and Tom, if you want to comment on Gulnara's character, please do. But also, I'm looking at your report, and we'll get into like the crimes that she's responsible for, and the corruption that she was involved in, and got other people involved in with her too. The report describes the United Kingdom as a key spoke in this network of property. Can you elaborate on that a little bit? What do you mean by a key spoke in this network?
Sure. Well, I think to me, Gulnara represents almost the purest example of a kleptocrat that we have. You know, Chris laid it out quite well there, but any money making business in Uzbekistan that she could get her hands on, she did, from Coca-Cola to cement factories to oil and gas to property to duty free shops to tea companies. Basically, Gulnara had a finger in that pie, and the only reason she was allowed to do that was because of her familial link to the president. You know, she didn't really have any particular expertise in business. It was pure nepotism. It was pure corruption. And that was one of the reasons we wrote the report, was to just highlight her crimes, but also to emphasize how the Western countries have enabled her to do that, and the UK in particular. Here she has had over £50 million worth of property, but also a lot of the companies that she used were registered either in mainland United Kingdom or in our overseas territories, in Gibraltar, in the British Virgin Islands. And it was these vehicles that she used to perpetrate these crimes.
Give me an idea of what kind of properties she managed to acquire. We'll move over to the companies in a second, but I'm just curious about the actual property.
Well, there's some beautiful pictures in our report. You can actually see examples of the type of things she was buying. But she bought a chateau in France, for example. She bought three different apartments in a block in Mayfair, very exclusive area of London, for around £15 million pounds. She had a smaller property for her son, who was studying in the UK at the time, and also she had a ginormous property in Surrey, just outside of London, worth at the time £18 million pounds, and that had a private boating lake. It had an indoor swimming pool, all the things you would associate with oligarchs and kleptocrats. Was found in this house.
Okay, thank you, Chris. You mentioned that this is a woman with no real business experience at all. I mean, she was in the U.S. briefly studying, even at Harvard for a little while, but no business background at all. So surely she needed help to try to get to manage companies. You mentioned the telecommunications service. Who were some of the people who helped her to start this illegal business empire of hers?
Yeah, I mean, it's actually quite interesting. I've had the opportunity to read quite a significant volume of material that's emerged from criminal investigations in Switzerland, relating to obviously to Gulnara Karimova and her business empire, a lot of which was actually administered through Switzerland in addition to the UK. They were the real two core offshore hubs, if you will. And what was quite, interesting was that what really Karimova had was a family office. I mean, that's a term of art used in the financial world to refer to ultra high net worth individuals. They usually set up their own kind of hedge fund, if you will, expert financial managers who come in and manage everything. They manage their investments, their private schools for their kids. They set everything up. They manage it all. And Gulnara had that set up. She had dozens of employees. So this was a well-oiled machine. It wasn't a one-person or two-person operation. This was a sophisticated business empire. And so it was a hierarchical organization. It was a sophisticated family office. It was setting up hundreds of offshore companies, what they referred to as dumpsters, because within this family office, they were well aware that these companies were burner companies used to layer money that came from predicate crimes and then to take the financial value and put it into investments, including those properties which Tom just referred to. And obviously, so this family office, it would then have people who would look after particular parts of her business empire. Probably the most famous person in that respect was Behzad Akhmedov, who was a real telecommunications whiz in Uzbekistan, a real bright young star, and he had a lot of acumen with respect to the telecommunications industry, and Gulnara relied heavily on him to do a lot of the muscle work with regard to negotiating these deals. And he was a tough operator. He'd get in there and really muscle companies like TeliaSonera to make sure that his boss would get the best possible deal in terms of these bribe payments. And then actually in the end with Behzad Akhmedov, he claims that he ended up being threatened by his boss, who believed he'd been involved in certain untoward activity that threatened her interests, and he fled with his family to Russia. But in addition to that, obviously the family office reached out to a whole range of specialist firms, which I'm sure Tom can actually jump on and talk a little bit more about. But, they used the services of Standard Chartered Bank in the UK. They dealt with hundreds of millions of dollars of money coming from the telecoms bribes. And we have obviously approached the Serious Fraud Office to ask what exactly the UK has done to investigate that aspect of the caper. And they simply refer to us that they've done general work sanctioning Standard Charter in regard to failures with anti-money laundering, but they've done nothing specific in regard to this particular episode. Then subsequently, Lombard Odier actually won Karimova's account from Standard Charter. They went after it because she's a high net worth individual, very exciting opportunity for a private bank. And so her business was moved to Lombard Odier, which is based in Switzerland. They had obviously, in addition to these banks, they had corporate service providers, they had law firms. And maybe at that point, it'd be good to pass over Tom, who's a real whiz in understanding the intricate kind of offshore framework that Karimova and her family office work through.
Okay, thank you. Tom, can you elaborate and give us some more information about that?
Sure. Well, what's interesting is sometimes actually Gulnara would have properties in her own name. So in Russia, for example, they were in her own name until things started to go badly. And then she flipped them to British Virgin Island companies to hide her continued ownership of those properties. But when it comes to, you know, more in quotes, you know, reputable jurisdictions like the UK, she would use solicitors firms and accountancy firms, and really use her boyfriend and ex-husband Rustam Madumarov as a proxy. So she was really kind of at the beginning, at least, hidden from view, and it was Rustam Madumarov presenting himself as the beneficial owner of all these offshore companies through which the property was bought. Now, in 2010, for example, when a lot of these properties were bought, there wasn't any information really in the public domain linking Madumarov to Karimova. But when it starts getting interesting is 2012-13, when details start to leak out about this scandal, and many articles did indeed say that Madumarov was Karimova's, you know, business partner and boyfriend. So what was being so then the question becomes, you know, what did the professionals who were involved in business with Madumarov, what due diligence did they do on trying to assess whether these links to Karimova were true or not? And I think that's where it starts to get interesting from an anti-money laundering perspective.
And if I could just jump in there very quick, Bruce, and just add to what Tom said, you know, I've looked at some of the due diligence documentation with Madame Aroff here, her boyfriend, and briefly her husband, and you know, obviously corporate service providers in the UK were asking for his source of wealth, as they're required to under anti-money laundering regulations. And in the subsequent documentation that was provided, they refer to companies, media companies, as being a source of wealth. And had those media companies been checked out, they would have seen quite significant reporting claiming those media companies are in fact connected, owned by Gulnara Karimova. So there was potentially here quite serious derelictions of due diligence. And another really startling case, I think, is one of the other main proxies that Gulnara used, and apologies if I mispronounce her name, Guyana Avakian. And she was, you know, the Takalant Limited. She was the owner of Takalant Limited. She was a person who, from the perspective of Lombard Odier, from the perspective of Standard Charter, she was doing hundreds of millions of dollars of business in Uzbekistan, of telecommunications business. So, of course, as banks, they should be saying, Ms. Avakian, you know, it's a lot of money. And they should particularly be asking that because at the time when she set up Takalant Limited, she was 20 years old. She was doing an undergraduate degree, I believe, in Kazakhstan. And when you look at some of the due diligence documents where she discusses how she managed at the very tender age of her early 20s to scale the epic heights of telecommunications in Uzbekistan. She refers to the fact that her uncle, who now lives in America, she said, is a bit of a mini tycoon, a bit of an entrepreneur. And through a process of osmosis, she learned a lot of tricks on how to get ahead in the business world. And just through a bit of elbow grease, she went into Uzbekistan and made it big. And those kind of explanations appear to have satisfied people, which just really begs belief.
Yeah, to say the least. Lila, also, before we get away to go to Gulnara's fall, I wondered if you could speak a little bit about Gulnara. She was, when all this was going on, she was actually an official of the Uzbek government in a lot of these places, right?
Yeah, she was an official, and it also obviously played a big role that she was the daughter of the president, and hence she pretty much had unlimited power and unlimited influence over the government offices. And with that, I actually also want to mention this very interesting situation that we had to face with the asset return and the court proceedings. And I think I will, I think Chris would be great in providing more detail because he was really thoroughly following this issue of how the courts in Sweden and Switzerland have actually made the decision that to release her money. Well, the Swiss court has made the decision to release her money to her, possibly. And the Swedish court have decided not to go after the officials that have bribed her because she was not an official at the time, which clearly shows the problem with, I guess, understanding in the West of the situation in these Central Asian countries, where you really don't have to hold any official post in order to have the influence over, you know, such decisions as, for example, you know, the licenses, and you really don't need to have a post to collect bribes, because as we see from so many examples in Uzbekistan and in the neighboring countries as well, the family members of presidents, they do this sort of business, and they do collect bribes, sometimes not even, you know, without an official without an official post. So I think, Chris, could you tell us that interesting thing about the court decision in Switzerland? I think that's an important point to discuss.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think, you know, and I think the point you touched on there, Leila, about, you know, is absolutely spot on a more general level. There is a real deficiency in international anti-money laundering, anti-corruption systems, that they rely on formal designations of people as public officials, which doesn't really register the fact that there are plenty of jurisdictions where people can wield political authority, can control organs of government without any formal office. And right now in Uzbekistan, I can tell you there are people who the Uzbek public may think have retired. They haven't, and they continue to control government at very senior levels, and they continue to use that control to wield to advance the business interests of their families. But of course, AML systems and anti-corruption systems won't pick that up because they're not in a formal office. And that's certainly what's happened in Switzerland. It's quite incredible. And because I think the tenor of this conversation, I think, has been that it's almost so well established that it's beyond recognition that Gulnara Karimova had significant political authority in Uzbekistan and abused that entrusted power for her own financial gain. But actually, in Switzerland, the Chamber of Appeal has made a decision that moves in the opposite direction. So, obviously, Switzerland has been a core site where her assets have been frozen, and the federal prosecutor in Switzerland was looking to seize those assets so that they can be returned to victims in Uzbekistan, which is obviously the Uzbekistan public. And what happened was they were originally successful in doing that, and then there was an appeal over an amount of $293 million. And that appeal went to the Chamber of Appeal in the Swiss Federal Court. And Gulnara Karimova's Swiss counsel argued that Ms. Karimova was not a public official. And if she's not a public official, she can't be bribed because she has no office to be bribed to abuse. And as a result, if she couldn't be bribed, then there was no predicate crime. And if there's no predicate crime, the Swiss authority has had no basis on which to seize and return the assets. And the Court of Appeal concluded and found in favour, large part, with the defence counsel, saying that from the evidence that they have received, it is, in their mind, just as conceivable that Ms. Karimova was a talented young businesswoman who certainly had a bit of family influence and used that to help some private clients get ahead in Uzbekistan. And therefore, that's not a crime. And therefore, the assets may well, it's not decided yet, it's going back to the lower court. But there is a significant risk now that Takalant Limited is going to receive back $300 million. And I think that's a kind of reminder. I think we talk about this case and we don't realize that actually there's been a lot of own goals here and a lot of failures. Actually, when you look at the entire situation, its entirety, you have Gulnara in prison in Uzbekistan, but she was imprisoned for organized crime offenses. And the government has rejected any idea that she wielded political authority and that she abused that authority. They've simply said that she's an organized criminal. So she's never been prosecuted successfully on this ground in a fair trial in Uzbekistan. So that's been a failure. And then you see the deferred prosecution agreements that were signed with the three telecommunication companies. But as Leila pointed out, the Telia Sonera executives were discharged or were let off because the Swedish court said Ms. Karamova was not a public official and therefore could not be bribed. And that very same rationale has now been used to thwart asset recovery or potentially thwart asset recovery efforts in Switzerland. And incredibly, the counsel for Behzad Akhmadov, who's a UK lawyer, I think, has written an article in a US law journal. And in that article, he in fact considers that the deferred prosecution agreements are an injustice, that the Department of Justice in America used its power to kind of strong arm these companies into signing these deferred prosecution agreements when in fact they were guilty of no crime. So in fact, the lawyers are going so far as to suggest there's not even a crime under the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. So it's quite an incredible situation.
So if I can just jump in real quickly. So if these payments to Gulnara Karimova were not a bribe, what were they is the question that I have, for example. Like how it's incredible, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the conclusion of the court is that unless it's an open decision, right? So the courts have not said, listen, we're concluding that Ms. Karamova is not a public official. They've said that the prosecutor has failed to persuade the courts that Ms. Karamova had public authority or political authority and that she abused that authority. And in that light, then yes, those payments made by the various telecommunication companies cannot be considered bribes. And I think that then means that, you know, not only for this case, but for any future case, and I know Tom's done really good work on this, on unexplained wealth orders in the UK that have been leveled or attempted to be leveled and against Kazakh figures, and it's been a failure because prosecutors are not very good at being able to evidence these parallel structures that allow people like Gulnara Karamova to obtain significant political authority. And they need to get much better at being able to articulate to that court, then to evidence to the court, that to the courts, and then link the payments to that political authority. And that is not happening at the moment. And so there's a significant challenge ahead.
Okay, thank you. And we have reached the halfway point in our discussion. So it's time for me to remind that this is the Middle East Podcast, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's current affairs talk show focusing on Central Asia. I'm Bruce Pinier, host of the Middle East and author of the weekly Central Asia in Focus newsletter. We're talking about the recent report from the organization Freedom for Eurasia on who enabled the Uzbek princess that details how Gulnara Karimova, the eldest daughter of Uzbekistan's first president, managed to illegally acquire billions of dollars worth of property and assets. And joining me for this discussion are Christian Laslett, professor of criminology at the University of Ulster, Thomas Main, research fellow at the University of Oxford, and Laila Nazgul Said Beck, chairwoman and founder of Freedom for Eurasia. Thank you. And let's go with how things, you guys were already talking about, everything starts to come unraveled for Gulnara Karimova. So what did we find out once they started bringing some of these cases to, you've mentioned some of this, but what are they finding out once they start to investigate her network and how she's been able to acquire some of this wealth, you know, in one case, buying back a company essentially for selling it off again for much more than she bought it for, things like that. And then we'll get to the repatriation of funds. Tom, do you want to go ahead and start, especially since you're doing the unexplained wealth? Can you tell us something about, well, first the organizations, but also some of the property in the UK?
Sure. Well, obviously, everything started to unravel first in Switzerland, where the Swiss bank, you know, was suspicious when Avakian was going to the bank and trying to withdraw money, and they found out that Akhmedov was Akhmedov was on the Interpol wanted list wanted for fraud in Uzbekistan, and this kickstarted a whole slough of investigations that really revealed that she was receiving these bribes from the telecommunications companies. And then since then, there obviously have been some attempts to repatriate some of the funds, especially in relation to the property. I think what the report makes clear is how far behind the curve the UK has been in comparison with some of the other countries. So, for example, France, where she had three properties, including that chateau I mentioned earlier. As soon as the French had learnt about this, they raided the properties in 2013 and had them frozen by 2014. Now, there's certainly been questions raised about the transparency of that repatriation, but at least the French authorities did something. Whereas in the UK, there are lists online documenting how Gulnara had all these properties in Mayfair. Even Tatler magazine, a kind of fashion magazine in the UK, had a report on the rich and famous and mentioned Gulnara having these properties. Yet it took the UK a further 3 years to seemingly do anything. And it was 2017 that the Serious Fraud Office produced a freezing order on three of the properties, at which point two of the other properties, so she had five in total, had already been sold. There's a question about whether they could have acted in time based on the information to prevent that sale. But certainly they could have done something before 2017. And that case is still ongoing. So we're 6 years shy now of 2017, and still the Serious Fraud Office is working on trying to recover the money from those three remaining properties. It's not really good enough.
Chris, one of the things that strikes me about Gulnara Karimova and her fall from grace is that it ended up being something of a total collapse. So she was able to operate for all these years. And then once the first investigation and court case starts, then everything starts to fall apart right away. One, how do you think she managed to continue to work for so long when there was clearly all this evidence around, as we see from the ensuing law cases? And why do you think they waited until, there were so many countries and so many different companies involved in this? Why did they wait until finally someone broke the ice and then everyone kind of jumped on this in their own countries and started investigating her?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting question. I think that, the ice broke, as you said. I mean, she, there was a lot of evidence. Really, I mean, I think you can go back to almost 2003, where there was some excellent work done by a range of different reporters, one from the Moscow Times, another one from the Financial Times, and they were raising the alarm back then. They were making serious claims back then that Karimova was definitely involved in, some very sketchy dealings. And they specifically said within the telecommunications industry, particularly through a company, it was Dinrabita. And so that was on the record. There was material on the record because her financial manager, who I might add now lives in the US, who he alleges that he was forced to work for her back in 2001, I think it began, because his brother was taken hostage by the presidential security services, and he was frog marched back from the UAE and forced to work for Karimova. After 2003, he fled to the United States and provided information again on these illicit dealings that Karimova was implicated in. So there was a track record that would have allowed any bank, any corporate service provider who was at all interested in doing a thorough due diligence, or not even that thorough due diligence, a sort of Google search or a LexisNews search. We're not talking about some highbrow stuff. It's very basic. It was, and yet nothing was really done, and she was able to prosper and was able to grow and was able to engage in a lot bigger and bolder enterprises. And Tom has mentioned cement, because gas and oil, it's so much that there. And I mean, it makes you wonder if, given her involvement in gas and oil, how much of that, where's that money now? That's never even talked about. Well, gas and oil in Uzbekistan is a huge industry. Where did all that money go? And where is it now? And who's got their hands on it? It's certainly not the people of Uzbekistan. And I think, you know, that goes to show that, and I can tell you right now that there are people, and I speak about Uzbekistan because that's where I do the vast majority of my investigative work. There are families there right now in positions of high office with vast amounts of political authority who engage in audacious schemes that are very much akin to what Karimova pioneered. And I use those words, pioneered. She pioneered an approach that has now become mainstream. And they're operating as freely through all the same jurisdictions, through all the same financial institutions. They're operating out of the UK. They're operating out of Cyprus. They're operating out of Switzerland. They're operating out of Singapore. And that just goes to show that actually the AML controls that we think should be identifying this sort of material are a bit of a mirage. And what ended up really being the downfall of Gulnara Karimova, it was not because the anti-corruption systems did their job. It was because Gulnara Karimova, according to Akhmadov, began to get out of control, threaten him and other people, and they ran. And I would anticipate that that had a fair amount to do with any information being solicited and to journalists across the world. And on top of that, you had machinations inside the Uzbek state. I mean, there were people who were very aggrieved with what she was doing and the amount of economic territory she had seized, particularly within the security services, who at the time were extremely powerful. And they were maneuvering to oust her and to get rid of her. And to take over her territory. And they've done that very successfully. You only have to go and look at Zeromax and companies like that got muscled out of the gas and oil. Go and look at who controls gas and oil today, and you might find answers as to some of the people who may have been behind her downfall in Uzbekistan. But, you know, the point is that it wasn't because of anti-corruption systems. It was because there were people who desired to bring her down for political reasons that all this information came out. And once it came out, then, as you said, it felt like a deck of cards. The Swiss suddenly, had to swoop. And then at the same time, you had the United States and the Dutch governments both proceed to go after her. But at that time, she was a soiled figure. You know, she wasn't. And so in a way, you could perhaps argue she was a safer target because she wasn't in power anymore. She was disgraced. She was disgraced domestically. She was disgraced internationally. And it's easier to go after those kinds of figures than to take the more courageous step and go after people who are not disgraced, who are very much the top of the political pile, because when you do go after those figures, you start to potentially affect your country's geopolitical interests in the region. And obviously there are a lot of governments who aren't prepared to do that, and that's a real shame.
No, thank you, because that was really one of my big questions. You know, I mean, I've been covering Central Asia for since the mid-90s. And I remember Gulnara was a train wreck about to happen for so long. I mean, even in the late 90s, you could kind of see that this was going to end badly. And she was very greedy and very ambitious at the same time. Chris, you mentioned that there's other officials certainly in Uzbekistan that were involved in this. And this is a question that I hope all of you will pitch in on. But when the Swiss prosecutors were investigating Gulnara, They said later that the head of the communications department at the time in Uzbekistan, Abdullah Aripov, his signature was on many, many of the documents that they were looking at in connection with the Telia Sonera company. But Abdullah Aripov is today the prime minister of Uzbekistan. So would anyone want to comment on some of these other officials in Uzbekistan that seem to have known something about her? Because especially in Aripov's case, he kind of vanished once the scandal broke. He fell out of grace with Islam Karimov, but then he came back under the new president. So I've always been curious about his role and the role of others.
Well, I mean, certainly, Bruce and Aripov, certainly having looked at very closely at the court documents in Switzerland and also the some of the evidence which the prosecutor put forward then, yes, certainly it's been alleged, and Karimov has claimed in testimony she gave to the prosecutor that she gave kickbacks to him in return for him signing off on those deals. Now, of course, that's an allegation that she has made, and it hasn't been verified, but certainly that has been some of the information that's been disclosed in proceedings in Switzerland. To my knowledge, there hasn't been any other official who has been named. I might be corrected by my colleagues here, but he is the main one who to date has been named officially. And the only other thing to note is that also in Switzerland, it's not only actually recently we just discovered, it's not just Karimov and the telecommunications companies who are being investigated in Switzerland over bribes. So the Swiss prosecutor is also investigating Rita, a major Swiss multinational company that deals with agricultural machinery. And they're also alleging that that Rita was bribing Karimov amongst other officials. So that's the only other thing we know from the Swiss jurisdiction at the moment, that yes, there have been allegations made of kickbacks to the prime minister, and there have been allegations made that indeed the bribe givers aren't just the three telecommunications companies we know about, but also they've mentioned in the proceedings Rita. And we've also learned a lot more in Switzerland about Zeromax, about significant financial benefits that Zeromax was giving to Gulnara Karimova. But I don't know about any other additional officials in Uzbekistan who've been implicated.
I just wanted to add that there weren't any official allegations against, for example, the head of SNB at the time, Inoyatov, or the chairman of the National Bank or some other officials. However, when you look at the materials connected to Gulnara's case, it becomes quite clear that whatever she was doing was not possible to do without their cooperation. Because obviously, you know, she wouldn't have been able to even do those foreign currency transactions without the involvement of the National Bank, for example. And I mean, none of that would have been possible if she didn't have the cooperation from the other ministers and other officials. It's something that needs to be also possibly investigated in the future.
No, thank you. Because, of course, a lot of finger pointing at some of these foreign companies and foreign organizations that were involved with Gulnara, but very little talk, certainly in Uzbekistan, about who might have been connected to her when she was making all these deals. Okay, I am conscious of the fact that we're running low on time. I do want to talk about the repatriation of some of these funds and the problems. It's been mentioned during this conversation, I know, but this is something that's certainly important to the people of Uzbekistan. What's holding up the repatriation of some of this money? And can you give me an idea of where all this money is? I mean, how many different countries are we talking about at the moment? Tom, you want to start?
Sure. Well, the investigation into Karimova featured, I think, at least 19 different countries and jurisdictions. Now, I think this is maybe the hidden story of Karimova is you know, what has happened to this money. Chris touched on it earlier. You know, I mentioned the repatriation of the properties in France, and that was done with very little transparency. Several NGOs raised concerns about the process. There have since then been established these principles, the GFAR principles, the Global Forum on Asset Recovery, which really acts as a kind of a best practice in what should happen when you're returning money to an authoritarian state. And these include the fact that civil society should be involved, local civil society should be involved in deciding where the money goes, and the fact that the money should go to benefit the people. But when the money from France was repatriated. I think it was about $20 million or so. You know, perhaps not a large amount of money in the grand scheme of things, but certainly enough to run several healthcare programs. This money was really sent back with very little transparency. It was supposedly sent back to the Uzbek budget, but we don't even have details confirming that's the case. And I think that's the overarching question about all these repatriations. We touched on Switzerland and the horrendous mess that is with potentially $300 million going back to Karimova. But the money that is repatriated, we have to do it in a way which is transparent and benefits the people. There is a precedent for this in the early 2000s when following the Kazakhgate scandal, which saw various money also in Switzerland, surprise, surprise, frozen in relation to Kazakhstan's oil industry. It was held in a private account of Nazarbayev. A special foundation called BATA was created, which had the World Bank involved. And had certain provisions, like this money was not going, could not go to any Kazakh official, and was went through a special program to benefit impoverished families with disabled children and so forth in Kazakhstan. So we have an example there of how to do it properly. But we're not seeing that in Uzbekistan. And the danger is, as Chris alluded to, the money is just going to go back to different people who want, their fingers in the pie.
And could I jump in there just to add to what Tom said? I think that, in at least to give some credit, I think there has been admirable work done in Switzerland to try and set up a kind of structure that Tom just referred to. So the Swiss government, in collaboration with the Uzbek parties, has been looking to set up a transparent mechanism through which to return the money and to do so in a way that engages civil society. And so they've set up what's known as a UN special trust mechanism. And currently, unfortunately, only $113 million has been successfully seized. But that $113 million, that is successfully seized in Switzerland. And that $113 million will now be distributed back to Uzbekistan through this UN trust mechanism. So there'll be a number of UN agency officials who'll be looking after it. And then the money will go into a range of social programs that are designed to benefit the people of Uzbekistan. And there'll be a civil society advisory committee that will be there to support the work as well. So I think on an otherwise cloudy day, that is a bit of a silver lining. And obviously, what would be ideal, though, is if this trust mechanism had a lot more in its reserve than $113 million, because that is a drop in the ocean of what we're talking about here. We're talking about potentially billions of dollars. And you ask Bruce where it is a huge chunk of it is in Switzerland. Unfortunately, some of that money, as I've talked about before, $300 million or $293 million, could potentially go back. There was another $70 million or so that couldn't be seized because even though it was linked to what they saw as highly suspicious offshore companies, it couldn't be linked back to the telecommunications bribery. So it could have come from another deal. And certainly there'd be a huge amount of offshore wealth that would be in Karimova vehicles that have come from Zeromax, but none of the Zeromax related work in gas and oil has ever been prosecuted. So there's no predicate crime or justification to seize that wealth. And so that money is off somewhere we don't know. There's money related to the telecommunications bribes sitting in Switzerland, sitting in Belgium, sitting in Ireland, and it's all been frozen. And now it's really teetering on the edge. And the question is Gulnara Karimova's council going to really drive home this initial victory they've had and get back all this money? And then obviously that will go back to Karimova and her family, or will either the Swiss prosecutors go back to the drawing board and find a new tact, or there's another possibility, the United States government has also frozen the money all these assets we're talking about, because it all passed through US financial institutions, which gives them jurisdiction. Unfortunately, the US INREM, their civil forfeiture action against the property, is currently sitting in traction in the US courts, where it's just rolling over and nothing's being done. And that's obviously sitting against a context where maybe this would have been a primary concern for the US Department of Justice 3 or 4 years ago. But with the war in Ukraine and everything that's going on with the Russia sanctions, these issues have been pushed far, far to the periphery. And so there's a real risk, unless someone like the US government, or we've asked the Gibraltar government to do something, because they also have jurisdiction and could engage in prosecutions and asset recovery. Unfortunately, they have not yet come to the table either. So really, it's whether there will be either the Swiss, the US, the Gibraltans, someone has to come to the table now and do something for the Uzbek people and try and secure these assets. Otherwise, it could well be lost.
Okay, thank you. And we are getting running out of time, but I do want to give you a chance to make some last comments. I'm curious. I have one last question, although feel free during when you have a chance to speak to talk about anything you think we missed. Has Gulnara Karimova's case set some precedents in how to combat this in any way? I mentioned at the start of the show that she's not the only child of Central Asian leaders who's taken plenty of advantage of her situation to enrich herself, or in this case, the children in themselves. Are there more mechanisms for fighting this kind of investigating and fighting this kind of crime and repatriating the money back to these countries than there was 10 years ago when all this news broke?
Yeah, I wanted to jump in on this question because I really want to name some names and, there are examples. There is, for example, Maxim Bakiyev, who is living in the UK in a mansion in Surrey, and he is still, you know, running his operations out of London. He wasn't even investigated. And there is actually a number of people. There is Dariga Nazarbayeva, for example. She was investigated. If you have a minute, I will try to keep my part short so that maybe Tom can add some information on how ugly that situation with Dariga's assets in UK went. There is Abdulkadir. He is running his operations and is participating in the largest projects in Central Asia, both actually in Kyrgyzstan and Uzbekistan still. He's running his operations out of German and UK companies. This obviously needs to be investigated because they're laundering their funds through Western systems, and if we don't stop it, it's going to contaminate the Western democracies completely. And the effect that this dirty money has on Western democracy is really bad. It's eroding the institutions. It's now endangering the free speech here in the West. We saw that with slaps against the journalists and writers. So if very urgently some steps are not taken, we are already late. We are already too late to take action. And if we just wait for longer, the question is, will it be too late to try and find the solution? Thank you.
Thank you. Tom, what about that? You know, I mean, Dariga Nazarbayeva managed to fend off these charges of unexplained wealth. Are we any closer to, you know, in the West anyway, to developing laws to come after these people?
I think yes and no. I don't think the Gulnara story really changed anything. It really is so dispiriting, some of the things we've been hearing about today, that even with this, you know, the most clear-cut example perhaps we ever have had in regard to kleptocracy, we're still having these battles thinking that we're going to send $300 million back to this, you know, corrupt criminal woman. I think maybe, if anything, the Russian invasion of Ukraine, I think, has started to hit home, certainly in the UK, about how it was not wise to let this flood of Russian money into the UK from the 2000s. We are starting on that path. We have created unexplained wealth orders recently. We adopted a new register of property. So if you hide your ownership of a house in the UK using an offshore company, as Gulnara did, you are now going to have to put the name of the owner of that company on record. And I think certain preliminary evidence suggests that we have that there have been perhaps fewer offshore sales since this law came in. But we're still a very long way from tackling this properly. And what we really need to do is examine ways of non-conviction based asset forfeiture, which is a mouthful, but what it means is, you know, when we don't have a criminal conviction, as we don't in the vast majority of cases, we mentioned, you know, Gulnara is one where we do have one in Uzbekistan and you know, an indictment in the US. That's very rare. When we don't have a conviction, we need to look at ways about having how we freeze this money. My final point is, okay, we've maybe frozen some of Gulnara's money, but let's look at Kazakhstan. We have Tokayev talking about, you know, we need to get this money back from those very rich people in Kazakhstan who have made all this money. You know, what money has ever been frozen since Kazakhgate from Kazakhstan? You know, we're talking again billions and billions of dollars from oil and gas, from minerals, from property, none of which has been you know, recovered so far.
Chris? Yeah, I mean, to jump in on my end, I think that the challenge here is parity of arms. These organizations, these syndicates, these networks, they have so much working in to their favor. They're able to administer political decisions through informal processes that never appear on the public record. So they wield enormous political power, but it's completely off the radar. They are able to accumulate enormous wealth. They're able to use the best legal minds, the best financial minds available today to organize their affairs so that it is sealed, locked, stock and smoking barrel from the view of the public or even the view of the justice-minded investigator from a prosecutor's office. And then on the other hand, you have, you know, prosecutors and authorities in offshore jurisdictions who then have very minimal resources. UK, as much as anywhere else, there's very modest resources being allocated. I think the US is probably the only exception to that rule. There's modest resources. They're having to. They also have their own KPIs they have to meet in order to justify their existence. And there's little motivation in that context to go after enormously complex empires that are very faintly documented and have used all the complex secrecy and trust vehicles that the legal minds can develop to hide everything that's going on. So it's such a difficult task, and that's why it's difficult to see that we're going to, unless there's a vast injection of resources being put into tackling this problem, it's unlikely to abate. And I mean, my final point would just be to say that, you know, we can see that today in Uzbekistan, given that is the topic of today, that Gulnara Karimova was not a outlier. She was not. She's often presented in a sensational manner, but she was a pioneer. And a lot of the methods and tactics she has used to grow her business empire has become mainstream now amongst the political elite in Uzbekistan. And while it may be a new Uzbekistan, you go and talk to anyone on the street in the country, and they know the scale of corruption is bigger and bolder than it ever was. And you know, and we're seeing it in a whole range of different ways. Now, you know, now this isn't necessarily corruption, but the final point I'll make here is, you know, you only have to look at, and encourage your listeners to go and look at this, the really great investigation that I worked on with Radio Ozodlik, the Uzbek language service for RFE. You know, it documented a really worrying takeover of oil and gas interests in Uzbekistan by a individual who, when you trace back who his close affiliates are, it goes back to the Inayatov family, who were the former, the patriarch of which was a former head of the SNB. And it also linked back to Gennady Timchenko, a sanctioned Russian businessman who is alleged to be very close to the Kremlin. So, you know, that was that investigation, I can tell you, took 2 years. Now, if it took us 2 years to get that bit of that information out, it just shows you how challenging it is. And unless more resources are available and more tools are available, the scale of the problem is just too vast to tackle in the current situation.
Okay, well, that's a sober note to leave the conversation on. But thank you. And we are out of time. So thank you, Tom Main. And thank you, Laila Nazgul Saeed Beck. And thank you, Christian Luslett, for being on the show today. And a big thank you, as always, to Nathan Shoemaker, our Mejlis podcast producer in Washington, D.C. And a reminder, you can subscribe to the Mejlis podcast or a Central Asia in Focus newsletter by visiting Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's website at rfarl.org. Thank you, and we'll be back next week. Bye-bye.